Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is funded by you, not by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war or gun violence, not by the oil, gas, coal, or nuclear companies when we cover the climate catastrophe. If you believe in the power of independent media, please make your donation today of $5 or $10 or $5 or $10 a month or any amount at democracynow.org. Every dollar makes a difference, especially because generous donors are matching your contribution dollar for dollar. Thank you so much. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The reason we are witnessing these uproars right now, from DeSantis' strategies in Florida to the actions of the College Board, is that education is integrally related to social change. And this is something Malcolm taught us, both through his words and through his actions.
As the teaching of Black history is coming under attack, we spend the hour marking what would have been Malcolm X's 98th birthday. We'll play a major address on Malcolm's legacy by Professor Angela Davis, given in the ballroom where he was gunned down. We'll also hear from civil rights attorney Ben Crump, then Malcolm X in his own words.
To bring about the complete independence of people of African descent here in the Western Hemisphere and first here in the United States, and bring about the freedom of these people by any means necessary.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the G7 summit gets underway in Hiroshima, Japan, world leaders agreed to new sanctions against Russia over the invasion of Ukraine. Ahead of their first joint meeting today, President Biden and other leaders paid tribute to the victims of the world's first nuclear attack, the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima, August 6, 1945, laying wreaths at the Hiroshima Peace Memorial and planting a tree. President Biden did not issue an apology for the attack. A group of anti-nuclear activists rallied on the streets.
Biden is in Hiroshima, and he's brought along with him a button to fire a nuclear missile. I cannot forgive him for this. He needs to apologize to the people in Hiroshima.
At least 140,000 people died in the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, which leveled the city. 3 days later, the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on Nagasaki, killing another 74,000 people. Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida's family is from Hiroshima. He lost relatives in the city's bombing. Kishida has pushed for the abolition of nuclear weapons while leading the nation's biggest military buildup since World War II. Meanwhile, Oxfam reports G7 countries collectively owe poor nations in the global south more than $13 trillion in development and climate assistance. But instead, these countries are saddled with daily debt repayments of $232 million, deepening the global chasm of inequality. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is expected to appear at the G7 summit over the weekend to appeal for more arms and aid for the war. Russia and Ukraine have agreed to a 2-month extension of the Black Sea grain deal, which grants Ukraine safe passage to export food and fertilizer. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the extension would save lives.
These agreements matter for global food security. Ukrainian and Russian products feed the world. Under the Black Sea Initiative, more than 10 million tons of food have been exported.
The Pentagon said Thursday an accounting error led to the overestimate of the value of arms shipments sent to Ukraine by the Biden administration as part of a $44 billion military aid package approved by Congress last year. The Pentagon said by correcting the errors, it could send another $3 billion worth of weapons to Ukraine. The U.S. military has dropped its claim that a man killed by a U.S. drone strike in northwest Syria May 3rd was a senior al-Qaeda leader. In interviews with The Washington Post, family members denied 56-year-old Lotfi Hassan Misto had any ties to al-Qaeda, said he was a former bricklayer and father of 10 who was tending his sheep when a U.S. missile killed him. So far, U.S. Central Command has refused to say who its target was. Meanwhile, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is in Saudi Arabia to attend his first Arab League summit since Syria was suspended from the group 12 years ago, as Syria descended into a devastating civil war following Assad's violent crackdown on protesters. Earlier this month, the Arab League agreed to readmit Syria as part of an effort to reintegrate the war-torn nation in the region. Volodymyr Zelensky is also in Jeddah, where he's addressing the summit and will meet with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and others. Tens of thousands of Israeli nationalists escorted by heavily armed soldiers marched through occupied East Jerusalem Thursday, marking Flag Day, which celebrates Israel's seizure of Jerusalem and the West Bank in the 1967 Middle East War. Many of the marchers chanted death to Arabs and directed racist slurs at Palestinians. Palestinian residents of the old city's Muslim quarter were beaten by Israeli ultra-nationalists. Far-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir was among senior politicians who joined the march. Ben-Gvir was previously convicted of racist incitement against Arabs and supporting a terrorist group. AFP's Jerusalem correspondent Rosie Scamell published video of Israelis throwing sticks, stones, and bottles at journalists at the Damascus Gate, writing, quote, "They cheer every time they hit us with projectiles." Three journalists were wounded, at least two of them with head injuries. In the Gaza Strip, Israeli soldiers fired live rounds and tear gas toward Palestinians who'd gathered to protest along the heavily fortified barrier separating the besieged territory from Israel. This is Hamas official Ismail Radwan.
The March of the Flags will not bring you sovereignty over Jerusalem, which you turned into a military base. Jerusalem will forever remain the single united capital of Palestine.
Here in the United States, members of the far-right House Freedom Caucus are calling on Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy to suspend negotiations with the White House on raising the limit on the national debt. Caucus members said they're willing to allow the U.S. to default on its debts, something that could happen as soon as June 1st, unless Democrats agree to sweeping cuts in federal spending on housing, education, health care, food assistance, and the environment. They're also demanding Democrats agree to speed the approval of oil gas and mining permits and rescind most of the climate legislation signed by President Biden. In response, a growing number of Democrats are calling on Biden to invoke his authority under the Constitution to avert a debt default, a legal strategy that's never been tested. This is Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders.
In fact, the 14th Amendment of the Constitution clearly states, quote, it's not ambiguous, "The validity of the public debt of the United States shall not be questioned," end quote. Is this a perfect solution? Is imposing the 14th Amendment a perfect solution? No, it is not. But using the 14th Amendment would allow the United States to continue to pay its bills on time and without delay, prevent an economic catastrophe, and prevent devastating cuts to some of the most vulnerable people in this country.
California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein suffered far more serious complications from her recent illness than her staff previously acknowledged. That's according to the New York Times, which reports Feinstein's recent bout with shingles triggered a previously unreported case of encephalitis, or swelling of the brain, which can leave patients with lasting memory or language problems and other cognitive effects. She's also reportedly suffering from vision and balance impairments and facial paralysis from Ramsey-Hunt syndrome. Feinstein, who's 89 years old, returned to Capitol Hill last week after a months-long leave during which she missed more than 90 floor votes. Her absence also held up dozens of votes on President Biden's nominees to federal courts and the Senate Judiciary Committee. A growing number of Democrats have called on Feinstein to resign, but so far she's refused. Progressive lawmakers have reintroduced legislation that would expand Medicare coverage to all U.S. residents. The Medicare for All Act of 2023 has garnered more congressional support than ever before, with over 120 lawmakers backing the measure. Washington Democrat Pramila Jayapal, who chairs the Congressional Progressive Caucus, says 38% of people surveyed last year reported they did not get the medical care they needed because it was too expensive.
That's not to mention the millions who are drowning in medical debt and the millions who are one broken bone, one car accident, one new prescription away from medical bankruptcy. An estimated 68,000 people die every year solely because they can't afford health care. That is criminal.
In more news from Congress, legislation that would guarantee paid family and medical leave nationwide was introduced Wednesday. The measure, co-sponsored by Democratic Congressmember Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut and Senator Bernie Sanders, would grant everyone working for businesses with 15 or more workers to earn up to 7 paid sick days a year. Some 34 million U.S. workers still don't have paid sick time. In immigration news, an 8-year-old migrant girl from Panama has died in the custody of U.S. Border Patrol. Anadith Tane Reyes Alvarez was being detained at a border facility in Harlingen, Texas, with her parents and two older siblings when she began experiencing a medical emergency and was later pronounced dead at a local hospital, Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, said Wednesday. Her parents, who are from Honduras, said she was born with a heart condition. Honduran officials are demanding a thorough investigation into what happened. This is the first known death of a migrant child in Border Patrol custody under the Biden administration and comes a week after it was confirmed a 17-year-old Honduran migrant teen died at a U.S. Health and Human Services facility in Florida earlier this month. A 4-year-old child from Honduras also died in March in HHS custody. In related news, the U.S. Supreme Court has dismissed an attempt by Republican-led states to revive the Trump-era Title 42 pandemic policy, which was lifted last Thursday by the Biden administration. The rule was enforced for 3 years, leading to the expulsion of nearly 3 million asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border without due process. And Democratic Congressmember Cori Bush has introduced a bill that would allocate $14 trillion in reparations for Black Americans. The progressive lawmaker from Missouri spoke Wednesday at a news conference in front of the U.S. Capitol.
We know that we continue to live under slavery's vestiges. We know how slavery has perpetuated Jim Crow. We know how slavery's impacts live on today, from the Black-white wealth gap to voter suppression, to segregation and redlining, to disparities in infant mortality rates and other health outcomes. When the Black-white wealth gap is $14 trillion, it's unjust, and it wouldn't happen in a just and fair and equitable society.
Congressmember Cori Bush was surrounded by co-sponsors of the bill, including California Congressmember U.S. Senate candidate Barbara Lee, who also introduced a resolution to create a commission on truth, racial healing, and transformation. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, Angela Davis on Malcolm X. He was born 98 years ago today. Stay with us. For Me, performed by Sonny Stitt and Gene Ammons. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Malcolm X was born 98 years ago today in Omaha, Nebraska, on May 19, 1925. Malcolm was assassinated just 39 years later, on February 21, 1965, when he was standing at the podium before a crowd in Harlem's Audubon Ballroom. His wife, Betty Shabazz, pregnant with twins, and his four daughters, aged 6, 4, 2, and 5 months, were in the ballroom looking on. In February, the family of Malcolm X filed a $100 million wrongful death lawsuit against the FBI, the CIA, New York City and State, and the NYPD and the District Attorney's Office for concealing evidence of their involvement in Malcolm X's 1965 assassination. Two men were convicted of his murder and spent decades in prison, but were fully exonerated in 2021. Well, today we spend the hour remembering Malcolm X. We begin with Angela Davis, the world-renowned abolitionist, author, activist, distinguished professor emerita at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Her many books include Abolition, Feminism Now, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, and Are Prisons Obsolete? Earlier this year, she gave the keynote address at a February 19th event at the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Memorial and Educational Center, housed in the former Audubon Ballroom. Professor Davis spoke about Malcolm's legacy, as well as the increasing attacks on the teaching of Black history by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and others. She began by referencing the actor Ossie Davis, who gave the eulogy at Malcolm X's funeral, describing him as, quote, our own Black shining prince.
Ossie said the following in Malcolm's eulogy. Last year, from Africa, he wrote these words, Malcolm wrote these words to a friend. My journey, he says, is almost ended. And I have a much broader scope than when I started out, which I believe will add new life and dimension to our struggle for freedom and honor and dignity in the States. I am writing these things so that you will know for a fact the tremendous sympathy and support we have among the African states for our human rights struggle. The main thing, he wrote, is that we keep a united front wherein our most valuable time and energy will not be wasted fighting each other. Okay. Malcolm's words and his trajectory as a movement leader and a movement participant are as valuable today as they were six decades ago. They resonate in powerful ways because the change Malcolm was calling for, the change we were calling for, has not yet happened. And therefore, Malcolm's vision cannot be relegated to the past. His vision still helps us to imagine the future we want to see. Now, official United States narratives of past history always attempt to assimilate demands for radical transformation into a neat story of progress and triumph. The very fact that Black freedom struggles came to be compressed and constricted by the rubric civil rights movement, I mean, of course, the civil rights movement was important, but that was not the entire story of the Black freedom movement. And that in itself is indicative of this assimilationist tendency. The fact that we ourselves often refer to the movement for Black freedom as only a civil rights movement. During the 1960s, Malcolm emphasized the need to expand our vision. He told us that it was not only about civil rights, the rights that can be accorded to individuals by a single nation state and its government. Our vision needed to be broader. It had to move, Malcolm said, across the borders of nation states. It had to be transnational. It had to be international. The framework that Malcolm urged us to use was human rights. Now, Malcolm's trajectory and his insistence on radical frameworks has never been easily assimilable into a narrative of U.S. history as one in which increasing numbers of people get to participate in the circle of justice, equality, and freedom. And I'm thinking about the way in which Dr. King's image has been entirely assimilated into a capitalist narrative, which is not to say that Dr. King represented those ideas, but this is the official narrative, the official representation. Now, Malcolm's vision from the very outset, or at least from the time he made the pilgrimage to Mecca, was an international vision, including not only people in the U.S. and not only black people, but people all over the world. And I tell you that I treasure the story that was told to me by Yuri Kochiyama about hosting a meeting in her Harlem apartment where Malcolm met with survivors of the bombing, the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. And there's also a photograph of Yuri leaning over Malcolm's body in this place shortly after he was assassinated. And I often wonder, why is it that that photograph is not circulated more widely? You know, why didn't we see Yuri represented in Spike's film? This is a time when we can reflect on what we should call the long struggle for freedom. The long struggle for freedom conducted by and on behalf of black people in the Americas. The struggle against slavery, the struggle against segregation and secondhand citizenship, and of course the struggle of Africans against the slave trade and colonialism and neocolonialism. This is a time to reflect deeply on the long struggle for liberation that has already spanned multiple centuries. It is also a time to reflect on how we might accelerate that struggle in order to guarantee that those who have been denied entrance into the circle of freedom might not only be admitted, but by recognizing their struggles, their collective multi-generational vision, it might be possible to imagine future worlds. And Malcolm asked us to keep our eyes on the future. Future worlds, radical, democratic futures for all beings who inhabit this planet. And so, in the spirit of Malcolm's contributions, I want us to ponder a couple of questions. How has it actually been possible for black people and our allies, including in the first place indigenous people, how has it been possible to remain committed over so many centuries, over so many generations to this struggle for freedom? That is phenomenal. Each generation has passed on that impulse to fight for freedom to the next. And oftentimes, even when we thought the flames had been extinguished, we have a Black Lives Matter movement erupting. And so I think that that we should acknowledge the phenomenal quality of black culture, black political culture, black music, because where have we learned to cultivate that impulse for freedom? I mean, that is the reason why we observe Black history. You know, Black history is not just because there are Black people in, you know, various parts of the world. It's about what Black people have offered to people all over the world. And that is the desire, the cultivation of the desire to keep on struggling for freedom. It is in the art. It is the very heart of the music. And that is why Black music is known by people all over this planet. Now, there's also the question, which we have to acknowledge, why is it that racism has persisted for so long? And why has it become so naturalized that its proponents often believe that what we refer to as racism is the natural destiny of the world? Now, Malcolm understood the deeply ideological character of racism. And I use the term ideology to mean the way that we humans imagine ourselves in relation to the conditions of our existence. Malcolm understood that ideology, even when you define it as the source of illusory ideas about such conditions, that ideology's role is precisely to make the conditions of our lives appear to be normal. And as a matter of fact, the more normal something appears to be, the more likely it is to be produced in and through ideology. This is the point that abolitionists make about the seeming permanence of jails and prisons, about the permanence of police, about the so-called school resource officers, about the so-called child protective services that Dorothy Roberts calls the family policing system. To the way in which Malcolm taught us to engage in the kind of radical reflection on that which is ideological, we know that we can envision life beyond prisons and police. We can envision life beyond capitalism. Now, Malcolm used his remarkable oratory and his phenomenal sense of humor to trouble our sense of comfort in a world that was predicated, that is predicated, remains predicated on white superiority. Malcolm helped us to understand how we internalize those ideological assumptions and how their persistence depends on all of us doing the work of prisons, the work of the police, the work of capitalism, white supremacy. Now, I had the opportunity to hear Malcolm in person. And as a matter of fact, one of the things I'm most proud about, connected to my time in college, was the fact that Malcolm came in April of 1963 to speak at Brandeis University. And because there was only a handful of Black students there, I got to meet him. All the Black students got to meet him and to spend time with him. But that's another story. I wanted to point out that there are signs, there is evidence that we can challenge that which is ideologically imposed. And I'm thinking about one area that we've seen a lot of change in over a relatively short period of time. And that is the demystification of the gender binary. Yes. I mean, who would have ever thought 20 years ago that we would be acknowledging again the ideological character